question a cosmology fundamentally asks is, what is the story about everything? So to an extent, that should involve everyone.
There's a history to the notion of a black hole. There's a history that explains why we categorize certain phenomena in the same way.
Every epidemic is kind of universal and incredibly particular at the same time.
Now, the core question for AI ethics debate is how much of decision-making power we are willing to delegate to machines and technologies.
Science Social, a podcast series about how science, history, and society connect with and add to the big questions that we all have today. You've just heard from Alexander Bloom, Dora Varga, Yishu Mao, and Adrian De Sutter, researchers from the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science, which is the creator of this show. I'm Stephanie Hood.
And I'm Pakina Maime. Together, we're excited to bring to you the special episode of Science Social, where we talk to four researchers who, through their work, help us demystify history of science and adjacent fields.
Pakenham is a science writer and editor, and previously a journalist in residence at the Institute.
That's right. I spent 2 months talking to researchers and academics about the work. As a science storyteller, I'm always down in the weeds. So it was a great chance to step back and talk about the big questions, the ones that ignite their passion for their fields, haunt their imaginations, and sometimes keep them up at night.
Today, Adrian, Alex, Dora, Yishu, and others will help us explore the concepts, ideas, and approaches that shape the disciplines they spent years studying and explain to us how the past, present, and future are tightly interlinked from the perspective of historians, sociologists, and philosophers of science.
When I first joined the Institute as a resident journalist and as someone who covers the natural sciences quite extensively, I was curious about the different perspectives that the history and philosophy of sciences offer. I came in with a healthy dose of skepticism about the true significance of studying science as a historian. I had ideas of my own, some low-key presumptions, blind spots, and a whole lot of questions. But let me tell you this, the journey that I went on was nothing short of thrilling.
In this episode, we go back to the basics. What do the fields of history, philosophy, sociology, and politics of science look like from the inside? How do they help us understand the world and maybe even the universe that we live in?
Can history, for instance, inspire as much wonder and awe as some of the sciences it scrutinizes? Why do we need to think about the past when we're examining fields centered around the latest advancements, cutting-edge technology, and present and very pressing challenges? Can studying the history of science help us live better or differently?
We address these questions and more by getting to know, sometimes interrogate, the work of our researchers a little deeper.
We live perforce by half-truths and get along fairly well as long as we do not mistake them for whole truths. But when we do mistake them, they raise the devil in us. Adrian de Sutter's thesis begins with this quote from British mathematician and philosopher Alfred North Whitehead. Whitehead is the co-author of Principia Mathematica, a 3-volume landmark work that in part explores the intimate relationship between mathematics and logic. The quote that lords over Adrian's writing reads like inspiration, but lands like a thesis statement.
Adrian has thoughts on the practice of modern physical cosmology. It's a branch of physics that studies the structure and origins of the universe. He argues it forms part of physicists' attempts at finding a unifying model, or a final theory that ties everything together. Some of the largest and most expensive experiments on Earth and in space are geared to studying the cosmos and answering questions about what the universe is made of, how it was created, and how it's evolving. So experiments such as CERN's Large Hadron Collider, the world's most powerful particle accelerator located in Geneva, or the recently launched James Webb Telescope.
The notion of a single theory to explain everything, the equivalent of a ring that rules them all as per Tolkien's fantasy world, has haunted physicists and cosmologists' dreams for decades. It fueled their work and drove their passion. But Adrian seems to be arguing physicists against the very thing that they seek. In fact, the way he sees it, the turn of the field towards a singular and final account of reality could be its undoing. Adrian, is this partly what historians of science do? Turn ideas on their heads, force scientists to rethink, or rather, try and invite them to rethink the way they're doing things?
I think you'll have two schools of thought on that. You will have one school of thought that will think, you know, our job is to work very much allied with the sciences and to support them in what they're doing, to prove, to kind of reinforce some of their narratives. But in all honesty, I'm not sure many historians actually follow that perspective. I think it is very much, you know, we come to it with our own particular questions, our own particular interests, which aren't necessarily the same as the scientists themselves.
Something that was really relatable to me was your move from astrophysics to looking at physics from the perspective of sociology and philosophy of science. I also came from studying biology and moved into the history of science. Before we talk about your current research, I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about what inspired you to make that shift from astrophysics into the social sciences and humanities.
I've always seen the work of actually doing physics or doing science, to the extent that we might be able to define what those boundaries are, as intimately related with some of these broader, more philosophical, sociological, historical investigations and questions. Because I think, you know, while we do the science and we learn how to do the science, they don't really tell us why we do the science. You know, what is its meaning? How does it fit within a kind of broader narrative, a broader structure? What is its history? You know, the way in which history is very much taught, at least for the history of physics to physicists, it's very much a quick one-slide introduction that basically reproduces or kind of says, you know, these are the great men, these are what they did, do like them, and then we go into the physics of it. But you don't really problematize that at all. You don't ask any particular questions. So I was lucky enough during my undergraduate to be able to do a course that was flexible enough for me to be able to choose between different departments. So as much as I did astrophysics, because I was always very much interested in kind of pursuing some of the big questions, I did a lot of philosophy, a lot of history of science alongside. But I was going to start doing a PhD in theoretical cosmology. But ultimately, I felt very much constrained, and I didn't feel quite satisfied by the options that were kind of the path that was laid before me. Basically, physics doesn't often offer you the opportunity to ask the questions that you're interested in, right? Whereas the humanities allows you to view this and kind of set your own question and your own problems to pursue.
Can I ask you what some of those questions might have been, at least at that time when you were studying both?
So I it's difficult to actually pinpoint on a particular question. I think I've always been interested, as I said, in the big questions, you know, what is the meaning of inquiry? What is the cosmos? What is the beginning of everything? To an extent, and I think we might be reasonable to think that the answers to that lie in physics. But as I slowly kind of entered into that, I came to realize that actually the answers don't necessarily lie there. They're in a whole, you know, they are in the world ultimately. They're in the sociological, in the political, in the ecological, in the philosophical, and in history. You know, it is in all of these. The cosmos is not physicists alone to uncover. It is actually all these different forms of inquiry and more.
This might be an interesting and valuable discourse within the humanities or even among physicists, but why do you think the public should care about this perspective as opposed to the quantifiable, reproducible results that physics and other hard sciences bring to the table?
So I would perhaps turn that question around and say that I wonder to what extent the public is even interested in the results that physics returns. How relatable is that? I mean, it's great. It inspires great stories, great views of the cosmos. You know, I mean, those were the things I absolutely got enamored with as a child and as a teenager. But what relevance does it have with one's life, with one's being, with one's beliefs, with one's way of being in and with the world fundamentally? I think, you know, bringing in this more humanities perspective allows that link to occur. The question that cosmology fundamentally asks is, what is the story about everything? So to an extent, that should involve everyone in that response. And the fact that it's only accessible to a small portion of our population and is kind of reported to them by the claims of physics, I think only really does a very partial aspect of all the promises that an inquiry into cosmos in its broadest sense can imply. And, you know, there are a whole range of cosmologies that exist. You know, they aren't just fundamentally dominated by a single physical and scientific cosmology. You know, people have their own stories, or I speak of stories not in a kind of to denigrate or to diminish that in any way, but to say an account for how the universe came together, what is its fundamental meaning, what is its purpose. You know, is how do you then make room for that? And I think the ways in which contemporary physics and contemporary science and modern science has fundamentally answered that is there is only one answer, and everything else is but a story.
Stephanie, I found that answer to be really interesting, and it takes me back to Whitehead's quote that prefaces Adrian's thesis. Is the idea of a single answer the quote-unquote whole truth that Whitehall was cautioning against?
I think, for me, that's part of what's so fascinating about Adrian's area of research. My understanding of Whitehead's point was that truths, to the extent that we have them, are only ever half-truths. In fact, his process philosophy argues that, and I'm quoting, "There's an urgency in coming to see the world as a web of interrelated processes of which we are integral parts, so that all of our choices and actions have consequences for the world around us." End quote. In this picture, each time we settle on a truth, especially those we consider to be whole truths, we also exclude other possible truths. In a broader sense, this is driven by and in turn drives what we hold and value as knowledge and reality and truth.
It's the other side of that single-mindedness of one discipline or another believing or being led to believe that they have some monopoly over truth, such as physics perhaps being regarded as the way towards understanding the universe.
That's right. Adrian's arguing that science or physics is not the only way to find it. There could be a plurality of truths that are interconnected and influence each other. Physics might be great in many ways, but it doesn't necessarily have all the answers.
This brings me back to something that Adrian speaks of in his work, which is a sense of anxiety among physicists regarding the questions that they're not able to answer yet about how the universe works. I ask him about that.
The crisis that I found in fundamental physics is, well, it has four main areas in which it might be shown. The first is in cosmology, the presence of these increasingly kind of ad hoc, speculative, hypothetical components that currently exist in their models, such as dark matter, dark energy, and whatever extra component they may need in order to keep the model consistent. Then there is a certain level of propensity that might exist in kind of speculative cosmology to imagine things like multiple universes, you know, a time before time, higher dimensions in which this current universe exists. And then there is, on the other side of the scale, an area known as high energy physics, where, you know, in 2012 they found the Higgs boson, which completed what is known as the standard model of particle physics, which kind of describes all the kind of microscopic details of the structure of reality in itself. They were hoping for actually something more, because for them, the standard model was actually a relatively imperfect model. So what they were hoping for was something that would be able to go beyond towards something, towards a kind of more unified theory, towards a final theory. And even though they were successful in finding the Higgs, they didn't find anything else. So physicists start running out of ideas of how, of where else to look for a more fundamental model or a more fundamental theory. And then there is also some talk around what's called non-empirical physics, which is the possibility that, some people are arguing that in order to find this final theory, this final model that might unify all other realities, such as string theory, the empirical verification of their claims may not be entirely necessary, which is actually, when you think about it, completely crazy to think about, that physics or physicists might be calling for no empirical verification to the claims. Now, that's not exactly what they're claiming, but the fact that people are starting to think along those lines is already the indication of some level of trend that there may be a problem currently emerging in physics, that physics is struggling to find empirical verifications to some of its claims. So it's kind of run out of ideas of where else to go for something more fundamental, for more final, for something more unified.
Do you think that your more humanities, social sciences perspective on this topic might provide or contribute towards a way out of that crisis, if there is one?
I sense that this constant feeling for unification, this constant pull towards finality by physicists, is ultimately a burden that's been placed upon them by modernity. That we've essentially divided the world into two forms of realities, one which is a physical reality, which we hold to be more fundamental than any other, and then a secondary reality of the subjective, of the psychological. And in the construction of this, we've fundamentally given physicists the responsibility for the most fundamental of all the realities. If we are allowed to interrogate this and to kind of almost divest it of this importance, as it were, and to affirm the reality of other kinds of ways of being, other forms of realities, then perhaps we might be able to divest them from the burden that they feel. The responsibility, it's a great responsibility that they've been given to uncover everything. How exhausting that must be.
As a journalist, I can't help but wonder how much the media and how we cover physics has contributed to this notion that it has final answers to everything about life and the universe, and also that it somehow transcends other disciplines. Especially what Adrian said about people asking physicists about God or the metaphysical. I still remember how the media used to refer to the Higgs boson as the God particle when it was first discovered back in 2012.
There is something really powerful that a humanities or social sciences understanding of STEM sciences can bring. Something that's very valuable to understanding everything, including the universe. This is also important because whose knowledge gets then excluded? If there's a plurality of knowledges that's all interconnected, is it time to start thinking more about raising up these ways of knowing outside of physics?
Again, with all of this, I should probably highlight that I'm not saying everything they do is this sudden fantasy. The reality that they uncover is very real, and it is it's quite impressive what they do. The argument that I'm trying to make is that other ways of conceiving of reality, of actually being in the world, can have a voice as well. There might be other alternatives that we haven't yet explored, but this is highly speculative, and this is also quite philosophical almost.
And there is nothing wrong with that.
I mean, ultimately, another thing that I've been quite informed by are currents that are currently happening in kind of anthropology, especially. So thinking about a world of many worlds, trying to take seriously the possibility of indigenous realities, indigenous worlds, animal cosmologies even. There's a group here in the Institute that kind of attends to that. It's called Reclaiming Turtles All the Way Down. You know, how do we take seriously? I mean, that's ultimately what speculation is to take something seriously enough to operate on its possibility.
Before I follow up on that, I'd just like to mention that the historian of science and technology, Lisa Onaga, is developing the project that you've just mentioned, Reclaiming Turtles All the Way Down, in collaboration with other researchers. Now, back to my question. How has the reception been to the work that you do so far? Did it create any discord?
In terms of my own personal experience, has been a very positive one. I think on the whole, apart from the zealots like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, I think is another example, I think people are quite open to the idea that there's always more and there's always different. And also, I should probably highlight the way that I've approached it. I do approach my kind of speculative investigation as a rather kind of a personal exploration. And it is, I don't try to claim to be a science, or do I try to be objective, or to say that mine is absolute knowledge in that respect. I mean, these are all very problematic notions, as we've spoken about. They have a history. They have particular values. My perspective is to say, I have gone in, worked, interviewed physicists, seen what they do, they've welcomed me, and this is the story that I have to say. This is what I found. And the idea for that is is to be provocative and to provoke new ideas and new thoughts and different ways in which we might approach it. Now, whether this might create tension or discord, as you say, potentially, but I think we're ultimately allied in what we're trying to achieve, which is a better ways in which we might come to engage and know the world in its many forms. And I think it is important that we actually do disagree, because only then, and that we take seriously what the other person is saying, because only then will we actually be able to come up with something new, something different, something perhaps better.
Next up, we talk to a researcher with a different perspective who studies the people who study physics.
Alexander Bloom came to history by way of physics, earning his PhD in theoretical particle physics before taking a turn of sorts and joining the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science. Was it a slow transition or a eureka moment kind of realization where you knew you had to be studying physics from a different vantage point altogether?
I was always very interested in history, but ultimately I then chose to study physics. And I really enjoyed it and didn't really question it at all until I like started my PhD work, really. And there, you know, with a little bit more time on my hands and also like having to teach the first classes, I found myself always, you know, going back to original papers and historical overviews in order to understand what it was that I was doing and what it was that I was teaching. And then that kind of coincided with the feeling that the field I was working in, theoretical particle physics, was in this period of stagnation where I felt, you know, everybody was just playing around with their equations, trying to build 100 new models that would predict new particles that would then hopefully show up at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva, which was being commissioned at the time that I was writing my PhD. But I just felt that was going nowhere. And so I just left physics after my PhD and I just dropped out and took a gap year. So I did a lot of thinking, obviously, during that year. I pretty clearly remember the moment when I realized that, you know, all of this stuff really still interests me, right? You know, just because I was frustrated with my PhD thesis doesn't mean that, you know, I'm no longer interested in the questions that originally brought me to physics. I just need to look at, you know, I just need the freedom to look at these from a different perspective.
Alex ended up doing a one-year fellowship here at the Institute. But being here, he said, made him realize that he can still engage with research questions that had initially brought him to physics, but from the outside.
Let's take a well-known phenomena such as black holes, which are places in space where the gravitational pull is massive that no particle, not even light, can escape from it. How would a historian look at such a phenomena differently compared to, say, an astrophysicist or an astronomer?
I guess the most obvious difference between what we do and a physicist does is that, well, we take one step back, right? We're not looking at the phenomenon itself. We're looking at the people studying the phenomenon and how they study it. And so we're one step removed from the phenomenon itself. The question of what actually makes this a phenomenon is really an important one, right? It's not that, you know, there are black holes just lying around on the street and then people are looking at this. It's not obviously a phenomenon. This is an idea that somehow emerges from scientists, from physicists' engagement with nature, with the outside world. And in this dialogue, in this feedback process, somehow the concept of something like a black hole emerges. And they think about it in certain ways, and there are certain layers to that idea. So there's a history to the notion of a black hole. There's a history that explains why we categorize certain phenomena in the same way, right? Why, for example, with a black hole, one calls a black hole both the supermassive black holes at the centers of galaxies and the leftovers of collapsed stars, but also thinks about miniature black holes that might be identified with the elementary particles that everything is built up of. So there's also connections that are created there, which are not connected to like some unique phenomenon, but it's a network of ideas, and those only grow historically. And we want to understand how those concepts come about, how that phenomenon really is created. There's a temptation to think this is really just a creation of the physicist, but what we want to look at historically is how these kinds of concepts emerge precisely in the feedback, in the dialogue, if you will, between the scientist and the outside world that they study.
I have a follow-up to that. How would you then say that a discipline like yours then affects the study of physics itself and developments within the field?
It's a real luxury to be able to do this kind of reflective thinking. We can actually write down and analyze the historical development that we're studying. But that's already, you know, that's the minimum that we need to deliver. Anything beyond that, like immediate usefulness or breakthroughs in science, that's not something we need to do. And that also gives us additional freedom in this kind of reflection, because we don't have to immediately translate it into further research. That really remains, obviously, the job of the physicists. And the way I kind of see it is that, the reflection that scientists are often not able to do, also because it really takes intensive historical research and dealing with archival sources, that's being kind of farmed out to us. We do that reflection. We actually deeply analyze the history and look at the sources and understand why we are where we are now and why we think about things the way we think about them now. And then we use that both to explain the current status of science and physics in particular to the general public, and to go back to the scientists and in presentations and in dialogue, provide them with the insights that we've gained from historical reflection. And then, ideally that helps them become better scientists.
Okay, here are some of my own reflections. I feel that both Alex and Adrian, who we've heard from earlier, were drawn into the realm of the humanities of science through similar observations. Adrian, on one hand, felt that physical cosmology was weighed down by a burden to provide a whole narrative of the universe and how it works.
Alex, on the other, sensed stagnation in particle physics and even said that while doing his PhD, big physics experiments were happening at the time.
Or were being planned, but he could already anticipate that those would not deliver the big new insights into the fundamental microstructure of the world that they were promising. Both Adrian and Alex felt they wanted to press pause and think about how the science got where it was. That said, although both scientists are driven by a similar sense of crisis and navigate adjacent branches within physics, they seem to have very different approaches.
That's right. I'd also like to point out that not only do they offer different perspectives, but the way that they engage with the field is also slightly different. So Alex's research interests lie in the history and philosophy of modern physics, and he's looked at attempts in the 20th century to bring together quantum theory and general relativity, for example. Meanwhile, Adrian rather considers himself, in the way that he's described himself, more of a sociologist of science than a historian. So he still uses historical examples, but to make sense of what it means for our story of the cosmos to have become a science, and what that leaves for other modes of cosmological inquiry, those outside of physics.
As an outsider, I find it interesting how these branches and research questions within history of science merge and diverge, and how different researchers define their place and approach within this world. As you said, Adrian doesn't even consider himself a historian per se in a history of science institute.
And we've seen this with other researchers. There are many ways in which disciplines intersect and diverge from each other at the Institute and contribute to the cumulative growth of knowledge and understanding about a field from different angles. There's a lot of intersecting between perspectives, perhaps a bit like what Adrian describes the need for, this interconnectedness between fields or ways of knowing and understanding.
Ahead of this episode, we talked to Carolina Sobeska, who is both an artist and researcher. Carolina carries out projects to create conversations focused on climate change
and technological development. She describes them as experimental and artistic. For instance, her art exhibit and research project, the Carbon Catalog, traces how the notion of carbon is shifting and transforming across China.
We also talked to Rocco Gadanzi, a physicist and historian of science, whose work is born out of a fascination with the thinking processes and knowledge involved in a complex discovery. His research analyzes two distinct worlds, that of solid matter, complex and composite bodies, and the world of elementary particles. We also chatted with Ben Johnson, whose work looks at the social side of a scientific breakthrough. His new book explores communication between scientists, such as Fritz Haber and Walter Nernst, to understand the history of the discovery of ammonia synthesis. This way, we can understand and break down the complexity of scientific research. For him, the story shows how communication and interdisciplinary exchange creates new scientific knowledge and enables problems to be solved. It's an interesting story in its own right.
By looking at that history, he's able to draw parallels between then and now regarding how basic research is transferred into industry. One of the questions his work poses is, what can the past tell us about how we implement the energy transition needed to combat climate change on a global scale in this day and age? Each one of these projects is a different beast and might span several disciplines.
So some projects are more concerned with theory and how fundamental research is conducted, such as Alex's work. Others are more rooted in the knowledge produced in specific times or regions, or they explore wider philosophical questions as to what certain scientific ideas or cultures mean on a wider scale for how we understand existence, such as Adrian's work. Others still bring a more global reading of the research they're doing, and their work might even feel more resonant to people outside of their fields.
You're now listening to Science Social. Up next, how the third eye of history can help us understand current predicaments.
Historically, you can see beyond the pandemics. You can see the before and the after.
That's according to Dora Varga, who's our next guest.
She said that during one of our discussions.
And I think it describes her work perfectly.
Dora is a historian of medicine and science. She has looked at epidemics during the Cold War, and right now she's doing a lot of collaborative work relating to the COVID-19 pandemic.
What I love about Dora's research is that it's very obviously relevant to our lives in the here and now. Studying the history of a pandemic is something I can easily wrap my head around. I also find the insights from such work are immediately relatable and applicable. When we're experiencing something as huge as a pandemic like COVID, which has swept through our lives and upended our sense of normal, it's hard to press pause and there is often little time for reflection. You're scrambling. If you're an epidemiologist or a virologist, you're studying trends, testing vaccines, or looking for a cure. If you're a doctor or nurse, you're down in the trenches. If you're not a scientist or a medical professional, you're just trying to find your footing in a very scary and rapidly changing world.
Exactly. But according to Dora, what historians have on their side is time. Unlike many of us, historians, in Dora's words, have the luxury of analyzing moments of crisis from all kinds of perspectives and asking how these insights can help us in the current moment. Let's hear it from her.
I think it's important to see how we got to this moment that we're in. It might be a new virus, it might be a very new challenge, or seemingly very new. But there are structures and there are practices that we have inherited, basically, that have brought us to this moment. And those structures, those practices, that knowledge can be limiting, it can be enabling. And we need to realize where those challenges lie and where they're coming from. What produces trust in certain medical technologies and not? So who is trusting certain knowledges and practices, certain actors? To give you an example, how COVID-19 has mapped on ethnic minorities and race is a very important issue to understand, but we cannot understand that without understanding the history of it, the medical history of how that trust has been eroded or was never there between certain parts of the population and medical authorities. Also, looking beyond the immediate interactions of experiencing the pandemic, we can see the structures that give a backdrop to the way vaccines have traveled from one place to another, for instance. So what are the routes that have been established? Why is there, you know, Chinese vaccine going into Latin America? What is that based on? What past connections and practices is that based on? What kind of ways do vaccines, are vaccines used in diplomatic encounters? Who gets what kind of vaccines? What kind of vaccines travel and do not travel? What kind of vaccines are accepted as proof of immunity and others not? Those all have those kind of questions and those kind of ways of figuring out all have a history that I think is important to understand for us to be able to tackle the challenges that we're in.
You just heard from Dora Varga about the foresight that historians of medicine can offer. We will go deeper into that and the future projections that historians can make about long-term disease and specifically its effect on vulnerable communities. But I'd like to first highlight something that Dora said on what it was like for her to live through the pandemic.
Well, it was a harrowing experience because there was no respite and it was very intense.
To Dora, what she studied for years from a safe distance was now happening all around her. And you know how some of us would escape from the pandemic through work? That didn't work for Dora. There was nowhere to run to.
I also became very conscious of that kind of everyday experience when there's an epidemic going on and how that frames everything, basically. But also the ways to go around dealing with that, which is incredibly personal stories. And I think those are very difficult to get access to historically because people might just be too tired and too sad or too traumatized or just too upset to document their experience.
That's an interesting observation. It's also a very personal one. Dora, how was it for you to do the actual work on pandemics while a pandemic was unfolding around you and affecting you and those around you quite profoundly?
It was very interesting to work as a historian of epidemics during an epidemic. One of those interesting ways was that I rethought some of the things that I wrote about before and suddenly either understood more or saw in a different light. But there were also the various ways in which people engaged with history that was very interesting and to see that unfold in real time. So in the beginning, when there was a lot of uncertainty, you know, we don't know how this spreads. We're not exactly sure what this is. We don't know where this is going. So there's no real-time current information to rely on. So people, and that's when, you know, newspapers and radio and television was, okay, let's ask the historians. Because what you can do is reach the past. People have been in this situation before, you know, what was going on then, how we can use that to understand. And a lot of those questions and a lot of those interests were very superficial, trying to actually, you know, kind of lessons learned from the past, parallels. And this is one thing that I think is very important. Every epidemic is kind of universal and incredibly particular at the same time. It's happening in very different societies, in very different scientific contexts, very different technologies, very different national geopolitical situations.
Depending on where you live, you've probably experienced a very different version of this global health crisis, say, compared to someone on the other side of the world. There can be starkly different, even emotional reactions to objects or ideas related to the pandemic. Something as seemingly straightforward as a face mask can be a normal occurrence or a subject of controversy depending on where you are.
In addition to that, the fact that information was traveling very fast between different parts of the globe, thanks to, say, the internet and social media, may have complicated things as well as made some of the things easier compared to previous epidemics or pandemics.
And people were and still are trying to assess things and weigh in on them as they're happening. We saw that with vaccines, for instance, specifically with regards to skepticism and hesitancy. You've got people sharing notes about their symptoms too, and experts and doctors engaging with that. Dora Avley described it in a previous conversation as transparent but unfiltered communication. Here are some of her observations.
you know, as we all know, a lot of things are happening at the same time parallelly, and a lot of things are changing very quickly in an epidemic. There's new scientific information coming out, different technologies. Are these treatments working? Is this the vaccine that we're going with? Changing lockdown regulations. And all of those have certain effects on society, on politics, and it's all entwined. And basically, it's a huge mess. And to untangle that and to understand that in real time as we go is incredibly difficult, especially because it keeps changing. So historians have the opportunity to, we have the luxury of time, of looking back and sitting down with our sources and sifting through all that complexity to understand, you know, what was going on and what are the consequences of certain policies. And that enables us to ask questions. It doesn't necessarily enable us to draw, you know, parallels and to go back and see transportable models, but it definitely is a very useful way of using that as analytical entry point to figure out what's going on now. And that kind of temporality that historians are obsessed with, we're obsessed with, you know, where something begins and where it ends, what happens in the meantime, and how these endpoints and beginning points are contested. Because we can see these historical events, these crises that we're in, for instance, now, on a wider temporal scale. So when I started looking at polio epidemics in the 1950s, and I was trying to figure out, you know, where do I end the story? And I realized that actually one of the most interesting parts is the after of the story. Because polio, just like COVID, has elements that will carry on into the future well beyond when the epidemic curves have settled down, well beyond when any kind of regulation or government response or even medical response is structured. And that is imprinted on people's bodies, that is imprinted on experiences and family stories that may carry on for generations. So what I started looking at is how we understand the endpoint and what are the consequences of pronouncing an endpoint.
Mr. President, first Detroit Auto Show in 3 years.
Yeah.
Is the pandemic over?
The pandemic is over. We still have a problem with COVID. We're still doing a lot of work on it. But the pandemic is over.
That was U.S. President Joe Biden in an interview with 60 Minutes last September.
And it's the kind of thing that historians of medicine might be concerned with. Beginnings and endings, the social side of illness and disease, and the potential consequences of a political statement such as this one. Of course, this is just one example of the USA. We can't necessarily project this directly onto every pandemic or epidemic. This is what Dora was referring to when she said that the work of historians of medicine and science isn't just about drawing blind parallels between past and present, because many factors come into play.
I think this, if anything, underscores the importance of integrating historical perspective into pandemic response and management. Historians can provide not only context, but the analysis needed to make sense of that context.
And they can also help us decide whether or not it's applicable in the present moment.
Such as the question of actually who gets to decide when a disease like this, with active cases and long-term side effects, is over once and for all. I think this is a case in point.
So, you know, the stakes of pronouncing an end are very high, and it's very complex to do because, of course, and this will sound very, you know, basic, but we only know that something ended once it had ended and it's no more. So it's always a retrospective action. So when Joe Biden or the WHO pronounces that something, that an epidemic has ended, it's always a speculation because we don't know where this is going yet. Maybe in 10, 50 years' time, you know, we can make that judgment. But at that moment, it's more of a political act. But those political acts have huge consequences. So Ebola, for instance, is a good example. And, you know, what happened after Ebola? When the WHO declared that Ebola had ended, they had to do that over and over again because it kept coming back. On the one hand. On the other hand, once they pronounced that it was over, a lot of international aid was cut and pulled out, and organizations pulled out of the affected regions in Africa and Liberia and Sierra Leone. And they were actually mobilized for the next pandemic, which was Zika, mostly in Brazil and Latin America, but also other parts of the world. And once Zika was pronounced to have ended, that very similar thing had happened with those funds. And yet again, there were people left behind, mostly women, parents, but this caring task was mostly carried by women who had to take care of children with microcephaly as a result of a Zika infection. So you can see that there are almost inevitably very long consequences of diseases and epidemic outbreaks that keep going on. And then there's an epidemiological understanding of the end of the epidemic or the end of pandemic, which is either based on numbers and the curve goes down and we declare the end, or there's a kind of concept of now it has turned endemic, which is an equally disturbing and very contested concept, where it gets folded into normal life. This is how we live from now on, and the crisis is over.
But it's far from over for many people, and declaring a pandemic over, Dora fears, may render some people invisible, especially those struggling with long-term symptoms of COVID, as well as vulnerable communities. She called it a kind of erasure or conscious forgetting of those still affected by the pandemic.
Interestingly, our next guest also looks at COVID-19, but her angle is somewhat different. And that's just one of her projects. She also studies artificial intelligence and society.
Yes, AI and COVID-19 in two separate and very distinct projects. I can't wait to break this down for our listeners, how being in history of science means you can have a leg in each of these worlds and it still makes absolute sense. Before joining the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science, Isha Mao studied literature and digital humanities. She has an MA in global studies and she's currently doing her PhD.
One of Ishu's current projects focuses on artificial intelligence and how AI models are built across different parts of the world, how different countries and companies imagine and negotiate the parameters of this technology. So she's looking at AI from a sociological perspective.
And this is important because it will shape how AI will be governed later on. Ishu's work compares AI principles across China, the US, and Europe, and notes how different actors, whether it's the state or tech companies, negotiate these principles. For instance, during our conversation, she spoke to us about how private sector representatives, such as tech companies, have largely managed to sideline what she described as deep discussions about the red lines of AI development and its absolute no goals.
Interestingly, her research, which is ongoing, tracks conflicts of interest too. Like how a large number of researchers penning AI guidelines are affiliated with private tech companies, or how some think tanks are state-led. Part of her research looks at how all of this plays into the debates shaping AI use, regulation, and governance.
Isha's work lives at the intersection of media, policy, science, and technology, an interesting blend of humanities research that defies definition. Isha doesn't consider herself a historian of science per se, despite doing her work here at the Institute. In trying to connect the dots between the different disciplines she steps into to be able to do her work, I began by asking her about how it all started.
I think one important milestone for me was going to the US for my undergrad education in experimental humanities. It sounds a bit strange, like what is experimental humanities? It's an amazing program at Bard College, a liberal arts college I went. And the core question was what it means to be human and how does technology and science mediate those meanings in terms of, you know, humans' purpose and values and aspirations. These questions still influence me today, but also because I come from China, I grew up in China, and I went to the US for undergrad education and ended up here in Berlin. Also, I did master studies in global studies. So I've traveled a lot and lived and studied in a lot of countries. Then that add on top of my inquiries, the question of how do the question of what it means to be human and how do technologies and science mediate that is also different and similar in different cultures and countries. And those are really fundamental questions that always come back to me.
While Isha is not a historian, she says that her research framework draws some of its origins from history of science. That's basically what ties her to this world.
It's worth noting that historians, sociologists, and philosophers have skills that cross topics. Also, those researching politics and governance, such as Isha or Carolina, whose work we mentioned earlier.
I've noticed that the work of the social scientists we've talked to so far is very interdisciplinary and sometimes deeply enmeshed in similar overarching concepts.
Take Isha, for example. What she's currently looking at in the context of her AI project is which visions or ideas are gaining influence enough to potentially become collectively held and institutionalized on a national or global level.
She asks questions such as, how will AI technologies shape society? And what kind of society and social order do we want to achieve through AI-powered technologies?
Isha's project also looks at how different actors plan to use AI to support, for example, sustainable economic development and innovation. There are many thorny issues there, mainly related to accessibility of AI, equal opportunity, and the needs of these three countries that she's looking at. That's compared to, say, a globalized network of knowledge sharing and AI development and use.
Based on this, we asked Isha whether or not her research proposes a vision for AI governance and ethics.
Now, the core question for AI ethics debate is how much of decision-making power we are willing to delegate to machines and technologies. So how much do we accept or want AI to mediate our lives? And then that goes back to, you know, what it means to be human, what's a good life for us? And this question varies from person to person. And why I'm looking at especially those really established actors such as state and companies, because we are in a time of AI development or in general technological development that we as individual users are very much under the mercy of state and tech companies. To a very small extent, we have the power to adjust a knob of these technologies to our preferences. So the future, yeah, very ambitiously I would advocate is that we really have power to decide how those algorithms and technical systems are run to fit our preference, what's a good life and what's our individual values. And yeah, of course, technologically, that would be very difficult.
This and Isha's other project, the one focused on COVID-19, are each in a hemisphere, at least in terms of the subject matter. But what ties them together is the common theme of how society or a group of people grapple with technology, social norms, policies, and politics. In this case, the immovable object of China's stringent policies and political hold over its scientists meeting the unstoppable force of COVID-19 doctors and researchers who still managed to get critical information out at the start of the pandemic.
And we are seeking to understand what does it mean for us to navigate all these crises and challenges that not just a nation, but increasingly global, we are facing together to understand who are shaping this, also a form of governance, but also how are they shaping it?
How did you manage to do that?
Because we'd conducted case studies looking at individuals, their experiences and their speeches and what they did through the beginning of COVID. Some preliminary findings is that there are different types of scientists in China. Some are very much, because of their institutional affiliations, very much controlled, or that they deem their obligation or like their loyalty to the party and to the states. As we can see from public information, their speeches and their conducts are more aligned with the party state's objectives. For example, there are scientists affiliated with PLA, the Communist Party's military, which is very important in the development of vaccines in China. But then there are also individuals who navigate very complicated, complex landscape and manage to express their personal opinions or their scientific findings and even data that are quite controversial to the public through social media or through scientific papers that they collaborate with foreign researchers. But as I said, that's in the early days of COVID. Sadly, that we've seen these scientists' command or their ability to navigate the landscape and still share their findings and personal opinions gradually declined as the party state strengthened the control over these multiple channels through policies and also censorship.
It's fascinating how the researchers we've talked to for this episode interpret the world, sometimes the same event in very unique ways, which is a testament to the diversity of perspectives that this field of humanities can bring to the table, which I realize now is something that we kept coming back to again and again.
Something that also comes to mind is that when Pakenham started working for us, she was unsure of where the history of science fit into her journalistic work. What parts are relevant and interesting to the public, and how do we shine a light on them? We were so lucky to be able to have Pakenham here, ready to explore this question with us, and to interview all these researchers whose fields don't immediately seem related to each other. One overarching theme for me is that we, of course, find differences, and that's important. But there are also so many connections between their perspectives. Now we're concocting ideas for more episodes to bring these interconnecting stories and their wider social relevance to the forefront. Historians of science, and those in related areas, are convinced of, or at least have a sense of the social utility of their work. And discussing this topic, even with just a few of them, shows us how relevant their research is to some of the issues we have today. Maybe this podcast episode is just the beginning of us exploring and uncovering more of them.
This was Science Social. I'm Pakenham Aymer.
And I'm Stephanie Hood. If you like what you just heard, please follow our podcast series on Spotify, iTunes, or anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Or follow us on Twitter at MPIWG. Thank you for listening.